Jack Israel.
Meet Joshan, an Iranian missile system that hunts down any hostile target flying in low altitudes. This and a range of other homegrown military hardware were deployed to this air defense maneuver, top defenders of Velayat skies. Held in Iran's sprawling central desert, the drills were staged jointly by the Iranian Army's Air Defense and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Division to bolster the country's defensive capabilities.
This drill, we've launched an integrated air defense network which brings together all of the capacities of the Army and the IRGC's air defense units. The two military forces need to work in coordination with each other to ensure the security of Iran's skies.
The joint drills send a message that Iran's armed forces join hands and stand strongly to confront any threat against our land and our ideals.
The two-day maneuver simulated real-life combat scenarios where Iran's sensitive facilities are the target and must be protected using indigenous air defense systems. The Army's Majid and the IRGC's Desfoul were among the new generation of missile systems that were unveiled and successfully test-fired in the drills. The domestically built systems were assigned to intercept inbound cruise missiles targeting Iran's nuclear sites. Officials say the maneuver has been a success, and this means Iranian homegrown weapons can defend the country's skies.
Today, we're capable of ensuring the security of our borders using military hardware that are designed and produced by our experts. Today, we do not rely on foreign weapons, and our cutting-edge equipment meets all of our defensive needs.
The armed forces also tested their electronic defense capabilities using their latest radar systems, including this newly developed GOATS radar. Built by the IRGC's Air Defense Force, GOATS is a pulse Doppler radar that can track and determine the location and speed of any target flying within a range of 500 kilometers and an altitude of 90,000 feet. Military officials say the country's self-sufficiency is thanks to decades of U.S.-imposed arms embargoes that led Iran to a point where it no longer needs to import defense equipment. It's the second and final phase of the maneuvers, and the Iranian air defense says all of the set goals have so far been achieved successfully. Officials say one of the major goals was to show that Iran's security is not tied to foreign arms, and the country's skies are safer with homegrown weapons. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Seyed Mohsen Abbas. He's a journalist and political analyst joining us from London. Also joining us is John Busnish, journalist and political analyst who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, John Busnich. You're looking at these military drills that are rather vast in scale and scope. Some of the details, these involve air defense units, domestically developed military hardware, and there were joint aerial maneuvers, another important highlight, that was attended by Iranian air defense divisions of the Army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC. Why do you think Iran is holding these military drills in this scope at this point in time?
Well, obviously, Iran is under serious pressure and threat of violence. just the United States, but by the American ally in the region, Israel. There's also a threat of involvement with Saudi Arabia. So this is a natural response on the part of the Iranian armed forces to protect their sovereign domestic territory. And it's obvious from your drills that these are domestic defense drills. It looks far different from an aggressive military practice. I see nothing wrong with this. This is the same type of maneuver that has been practiced in countries all around the world in every region. Nothing wrong with it, and no reason not to continue it. And the important thing that I've noted with your development in Iran is that your systems are homegrown, self-made systems, which makes you impenetrable to arms sanctions, which is one of the first methods that the United States uses to bring a target country to its knees. So I see nothing wrong with this. This is strictly in accordance with international law, and it's a natural element of the sovereignty of Iran.
So, Mohsen Abbas, war games or military maneuvers are most noted not just for the equipment, but the messages that it sends. So looking at one aspect of this, which is what our guest there pointed out, John Bosnich, talked about the indigenous capabilities. And we're looking at air defense missile systems, radars, reconnaissance equipment, electronic warfare devices, communication systems, visual surveillance network, just to name a few, again, all indigenously made. What message does that send?
Well, it sends a message that Iran is totally unreliant on external forces for its self-defense. That is thanks to the American embargoes, ironically enough. It's the sanctions that the Americans have placed persistently over four decades, which have, in a way, made it absolutely no-brainer for the Iranians to develop their own. But I think it's not to be underestimated just how brilliant the development of those indigenous weapons has been as an achievement for Iran, a nation which wasn't able to get its hands on information or even industrial parts, etc. For them to have achieved this self-sufficiency is incredible. In fact, it's got to the point where Iran is now ranked openly as the 14th most powerful military nation in the world, certainly, and it's also ranked in the upper echelons in terms of design technology. So, for instance, with certain mobile missile systems, they're even ranked number two. So this is an incredible sort of achievement by any stretch of the imagination in terms of the weapons that Iran can now use. And it's the main and sole reason, I think, that the Israel and the Anglo-Zionist imperialist forces haven't attacked Iran. They really would like to as a matter of urgency, but they dare not because they know that this is not dealing with a nation that will not be able to defend itself. They know it's perfectly capable of defending itself. And it's, of course, one of those populous countries in the Middle East, and it boasts now, as I argue, in the Middle East, the largest armed forces in the region with over 1 million active reserve personnel as well. So that's significantly eclipsing all other regional militaries except for those of Turkey and Egypt in the region.
John Bosnich, the IRGC commander, he has said a very important statement here. Again, we need to make sure that we cover this, which is why I have to ask you what you think. And he has said that the invariable message of unity between the IRGC and the army in their duty to serve the country's defense. He said it was rooted in the dual forces' defensive cooperation during the Western-backed imposed war that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein waged on the Islamic Republic from 1980 to 1988. This dual cooperation of the IRGC and the army is important, but when he went into the context of during the time that Iraq attacked Iran, does that show, as you mentioned in the beginning, that Iran is getting prepared because it feels that there are scenarios that it may be attacked?
Well, I think that the saber rattling from Washington, both during the Trump era and now during the Biden era, is the same. And unfortunately for Iran, the Israel lobby inside America has a great influence on American foreign policy. Not only do they cooperate on arms development and regional military, let's say, coordination, the Israel lobby in the United States actually pays for the election of many members of Congress who therefore push a military agenda against Iran. So you're not dealing just with the United States' general imperial attitude towards countries around the world. You're dealing with a focused initiative from Israel in your own region. And given these circumstances and given the history of the American use of puppet regimes, as they did in the case of Iraq, to attack you from the side, I think that there's no doubt whatsoever that Iran is pursuing the rational, logical, and strictly legal approach of defending its own sovereignty. And I want to underline here that there are many people in the world that don't realize that the United States of America has invaded more countries than Nazi Germany invaded. This is not a joke. When you've got the President of the United States first initiating economic war on your country, which has gone on for years in the form of economic sanctions, then embargoes on a routine normal supplies that have nothing to do with weaponry, and the coordination of battle plans with regional powers around you, and especially with Israel, you have absolutely no choice but to prepare to defend yourself. To do anything else would be suicidal.
Okay, so let's look, say, Mohsen Abbas, at through your eyes, what Israel is thinking first. Israel has made numerous threats against Iran militarily, and yet you have these types of exercises taking place. This particular one that has spanned now for 2 days, very significant. I'm looking again. I won't tell you how many sheets of paper I have that talk about the different options that Iran has, the different military capabilities, like the pulse radar capable of locating targets at a range of over 500 kilometers and at an altitude of over 90,000 feet. So when Israel views this, what is it thinking?
Well, Israel is thinking its days are numbered. The truth is that Israel's entire, if you like, menace was this sense that you couldn't penetrate their Iron Dome, that their army was invincible, that they were capable of striking anywhere, anytime, any place, and they used to. They did it with the Iraqi nuclear facilities once upon a time. They hit all sorts of places in Syria. There was the time when they would do that very comfortably. They're still doing such things where they know there's no comeback. But you see, Iran is not Syria, and Iran is not Egypt or any of these other nations, be they puppet or minor opposition to Israel. Iran is a fully capable military power with an ideology and an absolute powerful core leadership, which has a real commitment to moral politics, towards justice, and towards really fighting for the oppressed in that region. That's something that Imam Khomeini left as a legacy. Is continued by the Rehbe Mukawama with the leader of Iran, maintaining that sense that Iran doesn't just have a responsibility internally to defend itself, but it also has a moral obligation to protect and to help those oppressed people in the Middle East who for decades and decades have been violated, their sovereignty, their rights, their humanity, their lives, political prisoners, left, right, and center, all being captured by the proxies of Israel, like Saudi Arabia, etc. I call them openly Zionist proxies. United Arab Emirates have declared it openly. The Bahrainis have declared it openly now as well. The Saudis are just not fully coming out with it. But you see, Iran stands tall within all this, with this its military capability. It was the mistake that Gaddafi arguably made as well, because he dropped his guard, didn't build up his military effectively, and you saw what NATO and the Americans did to Gaddafi not so long ago. You saw that also within the Saddam regime, in fact, it was his weaknesses militarily, which they also exploited. This is what the Anglo-Zionist Empire does, whether it's its own lackeys or whether it's opposition. It looks at the military power and judges whether it should attack based on that. Iran has the Zulfqar short-range ballistic missiles. It has the Qiyam-1 longer-distance, sort of 466-mile range missiles. The Fateh-313, which actually knocked out the American base after the assassination and murder, the extrajudicial killing of Lieutenant General Soleimani, was another example of just how powerful Iranian ballistic missiles have become. And this is what Israel is looking at. Now, Israel is nonetheless trying to do things to cause problems. Firstly, in the last month and a half, we've seen it visibly come in the open front line in the north of Iran, on the borders where Azerbaijani territory exists. They openly started trying to get their own corporations there stationed in Nagorno-Karabakh and the borders of Iran. Iran has given them an answer with an exercise there as well. That was one example. The other, of course, is that in northern Iraq, there's another border which the Kurds tend to have, the Kurds of Iraq have with Iran. And again there, we've noted that terrorist groups, Kurdish terrorist groups, have tried to make incursions. And these terrorist groups are backed and financed by the likes of Israel and America and the Western powers in order to see if there's a vulnerability and weakness in the northern defense of Iran. Iran's exercises there, I think Fateh Khaybar exercise was another indication that Iran is not going to take any nonsense with these maneuvers that Israel is initiating. Of course, Iraq is still very much infiltrated by Israel and America, occupied by America, essentially. So that side of the Iranian border is also not 100% secure. And we've seen, of course, with the fall of Afghanistan, yet another front potentially opening up for Iran with the return of what I call the neo-Taliban. There's no real guarantee as to which way the neo-Taliban will ultimately fall, depending on their sort of economic circumstances and also the attitude of Pakistan, which is very, very critical. Perhaps I'll go into that in your next question. But the eastern border of Iran and the western border of Iran are equally, if you like, in need of massive attention. And this is what Iran is showing with these maneuvers.
So I don't get it, John Bosnis. You have Israel that has threatened Iran militarily, has attacked Syria, has attacked Iran's nuclear facilities. You have Iran that has said the U.S. has relocated, based on information that Turkey gave, Daesh terrorists into Afghanistan, so there's instability perhaps that's going to come from there. You also have the situation, as our guest there mentioned, in Erbil regarding the Turkish terrorists there in the form of PJAC, and of course the U.S. military threats that have come here and there. And yet Iran is made out to be the bad guy by the U.S. How is that?
Well, I mean, that's standard demonization. If you plan to take a military act against another country, first you have to demonize them in the eyes of the world. So you tell any number of lies, you make any number of claims that are necessary to restrict international support for the rule of law. Because unfortunately, the way propaganda works is that if you can make the target country appear to be so evil that there is no that they don't even have a right to international law, then you have a free hand to bomb them, to invade them, to overturn their regime, to run a color revolution, to do any of the panoply of illegal acts that are now the standard course in the American empire. So Iran has to not only defend itself, not only have its own independent weapon systems, not only practice those weapon systems, but it also has to pose a serious response threat within the region. Because if the American forces and their allies locate just outside of Iran's borders, Iran has to have local regional safety. So I think that the next step now for Iran, now that it has demonstrated a military capacity to defend itself, is to work solidly to strengthen your ties with especially Russia and China. If Iran can arrange even limited military exercises in cooperation with Russia and China, I believe you'll have the security that you need to protect your country. These are important aspects, and of course there will be efforts by America and by Israel to infiltrate agents and disruptors inside Iran, but I trust that Iran's domestic security services have got that under control. Now you need to look to the world, you need to look to the UN, you need to look to the World Court, and you need to tighten as much as you can your cooperation with the two superpowers which are not going to allow you to be attacked, and that's Russia and China.
Sure, but it was very interesting, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, when the U.S., very tired saying, the use of other options or all the options on the table type approach here. The interesting part being that you have the U.S. Secretary of State making that statement in the presence of the Israeli prime minister, and also the Emirati foreign minister. And I'm going to quote what Israel has said. If the Iranians don't believe the world is serious about stopping them, they will race to the bomb. Israel reserves the right to act at any given moment in any given way. The part that is interesting is that the UAE is not too far away from Iran. So if a war does break out, the UAE, in one way or another, might be in geographically in that war somehow. So I'm curious what the UAE foreign minister thinks when Israel makes and levels that type of threats against Iran when it has formalized its so-called relationship with Israel.
Well, the UAE has unfortunately made a heinous decision for its own people. They've literally opened the doors to Israel to come in and take over the UAE, and it's pretty much happening right before our very eyes. And of course, part of that doing the deal with Israel has also meant that they're actually allowing them to become a military threat to Iran, not so far away. So yes, it's already been said very clearly that the UAE is very much going to be on the front line. If anything happens to Iran, it's very much within the sights of the Iranian military. Now, the reality is that the Americans are there in Bahrain with their Fifth Fleet, and
right.
They've got all sorts of other assets. But the fact of the matter is that UAE is, along with its neighbors, very much antagonistic. And we've got these two wings building up now, the Eurasian bloc and the Anglo-Zionist or Anglo-American bloc, which is building up. And Iran is very critical within all of that scenario.
I got to unfortunately jump in and say, Mohsin Abbas, I'm sorry, just to give 30 seconds to John Busnish because we're fresh out of time. John Busnish, Iranian president of MRAC, his slogan to build relations with the neighbors. Iran and Saudi Arabia are almost at the brink, according to some outlets, not confirmed, they might even open up their embassies. And yet the U.S. rhetoric is turned up against Iran, just with what happened tonight and recent statements. It doesn't go together. Do you think it's because of that the U.S. is reacting this way?
That's certainly a factor. Any advance in Iranian diplomacy in the interests of maintaining regional peace is diametrically opposed to the American and Israeli war plans.
Okay.
So by simultaneously defending yourself and opening your doors to friendly relations is your safest option.
Thank you for that, John Busnish, journalist and political analyst. And thank you, Saeed Mohsin Abbas. Sorry to have jumped in there. Journalist and political analyst from London.
Sure.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.
Said Hakim was amongst the Maraja that was standing against the oppression in Iraq especially. Of course, his activities was not limited only to Iraq. He was worrying about Shia community all over the world.
When we study his lifestyle, we see he was really capable of teaching advanced level. Why? Because he was given this chance to revise the book of Mustamsak al-Urwatul Wuthqa. By whom? By the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsin al-Hakim.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists, especially the Shiite ones, all across the Nation of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Mahdavi, and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, let's continue it on the scholarly life of Sayyid Muhammad Sa'id al-Hakim, one of the greatest maraja in the country Iraq and the Shiite world. On September 3rd, 2021, we missed this outstanding man, this outstanding Shia marja, among the most outstanding students of Sayyid al-Khoi. Let's get to the scholar life of this man, Sheikh Ziyaniya. What details can you give us about him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sa'id al-Hakim was amongst the first figures that we mentioned regarding the scholarship in fiqh and usul in Iraq.
Yes.
He was amongst the students of late marhum Khoi,
yes,
rahmatullah alayh. And after the demise of late marhum Khoi, the position of marja'iyat was mentioned for marhum Sayyid Muhammad Sa'id al-Hakim. And you know, maybe it's interesting for us that some of his books was produced in prison.
Oh.
You know, while he was in prison, he decided to compile and write some books. Of course, he didn't have access, yes, to, you know, to the sources and to the resources. So he just, relying on his mind, oh, decided to write some books. That amongst this book is Al-Muhkam fi Usul al-Fiqh. Of course, he completed this book after coming out from prison.
That's
but
right.
The idea of the writing this book and some other books came to his mind while he was in prison for 8 years.
8 years by Saddam Hussein Abbas regime.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, so Saddam Hussein, the chief of the Ba'ath regime of the time of Iraq, decided to hold a seminar and invited all the scholars in Iraq, amongst which was Sayyid Muhammad Sa'id al-Hakim, rahmatullah alayh, and he didn't participate in that seminar.
Yes. As even a sign of opposition to Saddam Hussein.
Yes, yes,
okay,
yes. They threatened him.
Yes.
And they said that if you do not participate, we will put problems on your way. But he insisted on not participating in that, you know, gathering.
Yes.
And the gathering was to give mashru'iyat and legitimacy to the government of Saddam.
Yes.
That's why he didn't participate in that program. And, you know, he was to back the government of Iran that on those times,
yes,
was the, you know, government that was defending Shia school,
yes,
of thought against the Ba'ath regime.
Yes.
So Ayatollah Hakim was amongst the four main scholars in Najaf. That when you want to mention the great scholars of Najaf, one of them is Sayyid al-Sistani, Hafadahullah,
yes,
Ayatollah Bashir al-Najafi, and Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sa'id al-Hakim. These are the great figures here.
Yes.
So one of the most important points regarding his personality that is based on the, you know, scholarship personage,
yes,
is that Ayatollah Hakim was one of the defenders of muqawamat,
mm-hmm,
defensive of Shiites in Iraq.
Yes.
You know, if a prominent scholar stands for the people who are fighting against oppression, this is completely different with the situation that someone who is not a prominent one, he is just talking about the issue and,
yes,
no one listens to him.
No practical,
yes,
yeah, no encounter.
For example, after the attack of ISIS, we all,
yes,
are aware of the famous fatwa of Sayyid Sistani, Hafadahullah,
yes,
regarding jihad.
Yes.
And Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sa'id al-Hakim was amongst those scholars who backed this,
yes,
fatwa.
Very good.
And they said that we all back Sayyid Sistani and,
yes,
we are defending those people who participate in this, you know, al-Hashd al-Sha'bi and stand against the,
yes,
ISIS in the
That's
battle.
Right. Thank you very much. Truly a practical marja who is concerned with all the socio-political or religious affairs of the society. And this is what we can say the Muslim community and the Shia community expect from the Maharaja, you know, to be active in the society and to be concerned with the affairs of the people. Alhamdulillah, this is so in the Islamic seminaries of Qom, Najaf, Mashhad, and Karbala. And we could see the students, you know, and the next generation of this Maharaja and their roles in nurturing the students and the people. Let's get to the other works of Sayyid al-Hakim, Sheikh Mahtabi. Can you name some of them for us?
Yes, sir. A lot of works, more than 24 titles, have been authored by late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sayyid al-Hakim. And this is because of his talent in the fiqh and usul. This is mentioned that when he was 32, he reached the level that he was teaching advanced level of fiqh usul, which is called Dars Kharij Fiqh Usul. And we know that not every talibe can be qualified of this level to teach such advanced level of fiqh usul when he is 32 years old.
You said kharij. What is kharij?
Advanced level of...
No, what is this term kharij?
Kharij means that they are not taking one book and start teaching from one book.
Okay.
They are putting one... Actually, they are focusing on one subject, and then they are trying to have a comprehensive discussion over that subject based on different books and different ulamas.
So this is out of the ordinary classified routine.
Yes.
Is it?
Textbooks.
So according to the personal reasoning, they have to deduct something, okay?
Yeah.
But that's why it is called kharij, which means out.
Yeah, actually they are...
Or outside of something. Yeah, okay.
They have reached a level that they themselves can extract the ruling.
The ruling.
They do not
right.
follow one single book.
Okay.
Whatever he says pertaining the subjects, they follow it. No. And they teach the students. No. They give their focus on the subject and then trying different views over that thing.
So this kharij here means, does that mean foreign?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Or overseas. It has nothing to do with overseas.
Okay, that's right.
When we study his lifestyle, we see he was really capable of teaching advanced level. Why? Because he was given this chance to revise the book of Mustamsak al-Urwat al-Wuthqa. By whom? By the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim. So it was not because of being relative to Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim to be given this position, because we all are aware of the great students of Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim.
That's right.
So among all students, this is the only personality who is given this chance to revise Mustamsak al-Urwa that we know of the place of this book among the library of Shia fiqh.
That's all right.
Among his other works, we have to mention a voluminous book in Usul al-Fiqh, 6 volumes.
Yes.
Which is called Al-Muhkam fi Usul al-Fiqh, another book that our dear brother mentioned that he actually authored this book when he was in the prison. Mm-hmm. Is another book with respect to the subject of Usul. Al-Kafi fi Usul al-Fiqh. And his commentary on Minhaj al-Salihin, 19 volumes.
Okay.
And besides teaching Usul al-Fiqh and Fiqh, we see that he also is teaching Tafsir al-Quran, and also he is known of teaching
That's
Akhlaq.
Right. Okay. Sheikh Ziyaniya, we have Fiqh and we have Usul. What is Usul al-Fiqh? I mean, is this the combination of the two, or no, it's a separate discussion?
We may say that these two are completing each other, especially Usul al-Fiqh. Usul al-Fiqh are al-Qawa'id and Usul that are implemented in Fiqh to deduce and to find the rulings and fatwa. For example, you need to find fatwa and the hukm regarding the issue of, for example, riba, usury.
Yes.
You need to refer to riwayat and ayat, the verses of Quran and ahadith. But how to refer to these texts?
Oh.
Here, usul al-fiqh, that are the rules and, basis and qawa'id for this referring are helpful and will assist you to, derive out the fatwa from the original texts.
That's all right. Sayyid al-Hakim was a famous... we can't say scholar in this field, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
And he had good students regarding this. You know, being a good teacher will give good students also.
Yes.
So one of the very prominent students of Sayyid Muhammad Said al-Hakim is Sheikh Muhammad Baqir al-Irawani.
Yes.
That was a prominent scholar in Qom, and now he left to Iraq and he is now living in Najaf.
Yes.
And his, teaching nowadays in Najaf is one of the most famous ones.
I mean, I've heard that it's been welcomed by so many seminary students.
Yes.
And, I mean, number of the people participate in his classes.
Yes.
Yes.
And, this scholar, Sheikh Muhammad Baqir al-Irawani, has compiled and, has authored some, great books regarding Usul al-Fiqh and al-Fiqh.
I think he needs one separate program.
Yes.
And
yes,
the
yes.
teacher, we have to get into the
so
new generation.
So he is one of the students of Sayyid Muhammad Said al-Hakim. And another student of him is Hussein Faraj Imran al-Qatifi, that was from Hijaz. And he is a prominent scholar nowadays there. And another one is Sayyid Abdul Razak al-Hakim, that was his brother.
Yes.
And unfortunately, he passed away after some years, that he was released from the prison of Saddam. He, passed away in a doubtful way. So, and I also should mention this, that there is a software made by Noor Software Organization in Iran, in Qom, that have compiled all the, works of late Ayatollah Hakim. 38 titles in 65 volumes are gathered in this software.
Yes.
And the subject of the books are fiqh, usulul fiqh, al-aqa'id, and the Islamic teachings.
That's all right.
So if people want to refer to this software, they may get benefit from it.
And the works of also other scholars, whole Islamic worlds, this Noor, we can say, center, the Computer Noor Center placed in the city of Qom, is really doing a great work of making, all these books into the software, and, especially for researchers all across the world of Islam, it made it very much easy in order to reach the outstanding resources of the Muslim and the Shiite worlds. Also, his fatwa regarding the new problems of the modern world, like cloning, like cyberspace and computers, were famous. I mean, Said al-Hakim's fatwas.
He was amongst those scholars that was worried regarding new, and modern issues.
Yes.
And give some fatwa regarding these issues. And of course, some of his fatwa was, novel and unique.
Yes.
But we should refer to the, reason that he is giving.
Yes.
And this is a norm in Hawza, that if a person is giving new ideas, there must also give a new reasons for it.
That's
you just not accept fatwa, in Darsul Kharij in high level, studies. So, but yeah, he was involved in modern issues regarding cloning, as you mentioned, regarding some issues regarding fiqhul mughtaribin, that means
which is what
fiqh for people who are living in Western countries.
Fiqhul
mughtaribin.
Mughtaribin. That's
So that's
the fiqh, which is for the people and the Muslims or the Shiites living in the Western world.
Yes.
Which have so many problems, have so many doubts and questions.
Yeah. In other words, Shia or Muslim people who are living in non-Muslim countries.
Non-Muslim lands, that's right.
So they have, their own problems, they have their own issues. So
that's Sayyid
Muhammad Said al-Hakim was a person who was thinking about them. And
that's right,
why
very
we are
good.
Saying that he was a practical, a marja of practice.
That's all right.
So he was worried regarding them and wrote a book regarding these issues and
very good.
Mentioned his fatwa in that book.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziaynian, Sheikh Mahdavi. On September 3rd, 2021, just recently, this outstanding marja, Shiite marja in Iraq, passed away. He was taken into the city of Najaf and was buried in vicinity of the tomb of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the whole city of Najaf. May Allah bless his soul and may Allah protect all the generation of Maraja in the city of Iraq, especially Sayyid al-Sistani, over there in Iraq, the true protector of the Shia Islam over there. Thank you, my Sheikh Ziaynian, Sheikh Mahtabi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher.
You're most welcome.
Dear listeners, thank you very much too for listening to us. This is the teacher, I'm Atta, the host of this program. Visit our website at parstoday.com/yen/Call of Islam page. Also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary to you. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Around 90% of Portugal's population is now vaccinated. In Bulgaria, the figure is just 22%. Both are members of the EU, but in countries like Bulgaria and Romania, people do not trust what they're being told about the vaccines. Senior European Commission officials attended a meeting of EU health ministers on Tuesday.
My main messages today: continue, vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. The difficulties that some member states are currently facing with COVID-19 cases at record high and extreme pressure on hospitals is a stark reminder of this.
Critics say EU health authorities are putting the bloc's vaccination strategy in peril by not giving a clear message on the benefit of booster vaccines. For example, here is what the European Medicines Agency has been saying.
So it's not a strong recommendation as sometimes we do when we really see the need of a booster in the overall population.
The Eurozone economy is already at breaking point due to the pandemic. A conference in Brussels has been discussing the growing problem of long-term unemployment.
It's like a car. If you let a car that is not used for many time in your garage, in your storage, it doesn't work like before. But it doesn't mean that it cannot be recovered at the full of their potential. But this is the responsibility of the government on that.
Gas and electricity prices are soaring in the 19-nation Eurozone, adding to economic uncertainty. But gas and electricity costs aren't the only concerns.
Oil, but also other commodities, and certain commodities like metal need a lot of energy to be produced, so there's a direct link.
And there is a direct link between health and the economy. At their meeting, EU ministers pledged to donate 500 million COVID-19 vaccines to less well-off countries before the middle of next year. Aid agencies insist the EU has a moral duty to keep this promise. Health authorities and economists say the move is in the bloc's own interest in the context of trying to prevent the virus from mutating. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
With Lebanon plunging into darkness as two main power stations barely function, Hezbollah Secretary General called on the government to bring on a complete solution to electricity blackouts.
We need to have a drastic solution to the electricity issue, build new power plants, solve the problems in the current power plants. There are several proposals on the table from various countries in the East and the West. If you don't want from the East, then take proposals of the Western countries, unless there is an American veto and the Americans are prohibiting you. Tell that to the Lebanese people honestly.
Nasrallah uncovered that the Lebanese government has even turned down offers from countries like Germany and France for fear of U.S. sanctions. He urged the Lebanese government to seek a waiver.
There is a new proposal given by Iran's foreign minister in Beirut a couple of days ago. He said Iran is ready to build two power plants and provide a very good amount of fuel. Give him an answer. Seek a sanctions waiver. For us, the U.S. is an enemy. We can expect anything from an enemy, but if you consider it a friend and a confidant, then fine. Ask this beloved friend, whom you believe has humanity, to make an exception like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Small businesses have been struggling and say they are experiencing what they call a slow death to make ends meet. What this man used to do using electricity, he's now doing with his own hands.
We used to see the electricity for 30 minutes or so, but now nothing. This area used to be a busy area. Now all the work and shops have shut down. Electricity is everything in my work. Now I'm working manually using a saw. I even stopped a private generator because I can't afford it.
Those who can afford it are turning to private generators. Rabia is the owner of one of the private generators south of Beirut. Before the import of Iranian fuel, the bill cost a fortune.
We suffered so much before, especially when we had to raise prices. It's always the people who have to pay the heavy price because of the black market. We thank God and we thank Sayed Hassan and the Islamic Republic who launched this initiative and saved us from the dark and saved the people from paying a very high bill.
Al Amana Petroleum is selling the Iranian diesel for almost half the official price with the subsidies lifted. While the leader of the resistance did declare that Hezbollah will be donating and selling Iranian fuel for the second month, he also stressed that this is only a temporary solution.
On top of the socio-economic crisis in Lebanon lies an almost total collapse of the electricity crisis. Hezbollah's Secretary General has called on the government to prioritize the issue in order to put the country on the track of a drastic solution. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's major nuclear facilities have been targeted by cruise missiles. Iranian air defense says it has successfully foiled the attack using homegrown missile systems. This is the scenario for a massive military drill held over a 500,000 square kilometer area in central Iran, codenamed Defenders of Velayat Skies. The air defense exercise engaged the Iranian Army's Air Defense Force and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Division.
In these dreams, we have simulated real-life war scenarios where the enemy uses manned and unmanned aircraft as well as cruise missiles to attack our sensitive facilities, and air defense units will use indigenously built defense systems to counter the hostile force.
These military exercises are held as part of our annual routine drills. They are not a threat to any country and are aimed at boosting our deterrence and increasing our preparedness against any potential hostile move.
The air drill involved the latest military equipment developed by Iranian experts, including missile systems, drones, and radars. Iranian military officials boast the country's capabilities in indigenizing the defense industry and say they owe this to the long-running U.S. arms embargoes.
We have gone through decades of sanctions imposed against our defense sector. But we prove that if we discover our domestic capacities, we will definitely be able to build up our defense arsenal and protect our sovereignty using our know-how. I should say that in this maneuver, all of the equipment are made inside Iran.
The annual maneuver started on Tuesday and will continue until Wednesday.
Military officials here say, given the recent developments in Iran's eastern and northwestern borders, there's a need to boost coordination and synergy between the Iranian army and the IRGC to counter any potential threats. They say these drills can help achieve such a goal. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
After taking power, the Taliban leaders reached to the Shia community
seeking their support and allegiance. The Taliban officials said their government will include all Afghans and social justice will be protected.
Today, Shia people are safer than before. We don't let any individual hurt you. You are from Afghanistan and have equal rights. The Islamic Emirate recognizes you as part of Afghan society.
The Shia Ulama Council at a press conference on August 24 urged the Taliban to ensure that they will treat all faiths and ethnicities with equality and justice.
We are happy that U.S. forces have left our country. Congratulations to the Afghan nation. In the meantime, we demand and recommend that the Taliban fulfill their promises by forming an all-inclusive government.
During weeks under the Taliban rule, many people from the Shia community have reportedly been displaced in Dikandi and some were massacred by the Taliban in Ghazni and Dikandi, Amnesty International confirms. At the same time, the Daesh still takes lives from the community. Nearly 300 Shia worshippers were killed and wounded in Kunduz blast on Friday. Following this tragic event, Shia Clerics Council in Afghanistan once again urged the Taliban to investigate the deadly attack and take massacre of Shia seriously, as well as call for unity among all Muslims.
Shias are making 20% of the population of Afghanistan. The Taliban can't establish an inclusive Islamic government without giving equal role to us. We also condemn the catastrophic attack in Kunduz and urge the Taliban to bring its perpetrators to justice.
After taking power, the Taliban promised the formation of an inclusive government and providing a safe ground for all Afghans. But Shia minority is concerned that the threat of Daesh terrorist group is being ignored by the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš is the most high-profile politician in the EU to be exposed by the Pandora Papers leak earlier this month. It was revealed that Babiš, who lost a re-election bid just last Saturday, spent €19 million using tax haven companies to buy a chateau in France. The scandal has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Andrej Babiš behaves again as a hypocrite, as a liar, as a person despising democracy, but this time also as a businessman doing shady transactions.
Hundreds of current and former politicians, celebrities, religious leaders, and drug dealers have used so-called shell companies to hide their wealth and investments.
Madam President, I am livid.
A consortium of journalists from around the world compiled a report containing 12 million leaked documents, dubbed the Pandora Papers.
As countries scramble for millions to fund health and social services, $11 trillion are out of reach offshore.
Most of those avoiding tax are based in the West. EU leaders who talk a lot about values are accused of hypocrisy.
Why is the United States, which is not cooperative, again not mentioned, whereas in the Pandora Papers it's very clear that the United States are becoming a bigger and bigger problem?
Experts warn the issue will never be resolved unless the rich and powerful develop a conscience.
I think that the ultimate question in the end is individual ethics, and living by good example, you know, by those, you know, who actually want to defend the system. And without that, the best monitoring, the best legal framework, the best regulation can't save you.
Legislators say a big problem relates to the amount of money politicians and policymakers can generate for themselves.
Where action could but isn't taken, there's obviously no political will to stop mass tax evasion by the super rich.
Revelations like these are nothing new. Lawmakers say it proves European Commission policies in this area are not working, and therefore it is simply a matter of time before more scandals come to light. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Karim Abu Salim crossing, the only crossing into the Gaza Strip for import and export, is under the control of Israel. It keeps imposing restrictions on movement and trade process. The Israeli closure of Karim Abu Salim threatens the economic sector of the Gaza Strip. These threats come in light of the catastrophic economic and humanitarian conditions that the residents of the Gaza Strip have been experiencing for more than 15 years of siege and closure.
About 90% of the Palestinian economy depends on the agricultural sector that is going through many disasters these days, including the continuous wars on Gaza, especially the 2021 escalation. Repeated closures of Kerem Abu Salem crossing has negatively affected all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip.
To voice their anger at Israeli restrictions, Palestinian farmers and traders gathered at Kerem Abu Salem crossing, the only way for their crops to be sold in markets abroad.
We have lost our money in vain due to the Israeli restrictions. Israel is pursuing a policy aimed at destroying our economy and making us isolated from the world. We demand an urgent help to export our crops to the West Bank and abroad.
Palestinian farmers and traders also expressed the crossing closure as an aggressive act that reflects Israeli insistence on besieging 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
By depriving us of exporting our crops, Israel intends to create chaos in our life. This has already affected our economy and made our life harder. I don't see any promising future for my family.
In light of the Israeli closure of the only crossing in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers and traders who depend on exporting crops for a living are calling on the international community to make action and stop these restrictions that cause serious financial losses. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, the elderly people. We are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B. Actually, this is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world. And I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes and floods hit regions around the world during the summer, and scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians don't seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians, be ambitious, because we're going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that we all want change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change the consequences of the past.
Referring to oil and gas, they chanted, "Keep it in the ground." Doing so might be unjustifiable in the context of economic growth and social inclusion, many analysts argue.
That's because for decades, the richest countries have become richer through the use of fossil fuels. Now developing nations are being told not to do the same by world powers. These poorer countries are saying, fair enough, but you must compensate us financially.
World leaders are being urged to tackle this very issue head on when they meet at the end of the month for a 12-day UN climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following the Americans' failure in Afghanistan, now the Taliban are rolling over Kabul and other cities and provinces across the nation. New messages painted on the walls in the city center are a reminder of visible changes. Our nation has, with the help of God, defeated America. One of the new Taliban slogans reads, replacing the previous colorful painting. The Afghan flag has largely been replaced with the white Islamic Emirate emblem, with many selling the new banners amid heavy traffic across the city.
After the Taliban takeover, I started selling the Taliban's flags and slogans. It is a good business for me. Many Taliban soldiers and their followers buy and display them on the cars, motorbikes, and houses. I make good money, and it is getting better day by day.
Another challenging change, the level of poverty is rising. Women are selling their gold to get some cash to support their families. Many have lost their jobs, with some struggling to make food for their family. Others are selling household items to make ends meet.
I've brought my household items for sale because there are no jobs. What should we do for a living? I asked the Taliban to create jobs. They must prepare the ground for us to work. Today we are selling household items. What should we do tomorrow?
The most obvious change is the presence of Taliban members themselves. The Taliban are seen roaming the city, guns flung over their shoulders. Some are wearing uniforms and some are in local clothes. And another change, many women